Okay, Boker Tov, I think we can get started. Hope everybody's doing well. And welcome, I guess we call this a sort of a mini-series between Pesach and Shavuot. It's ongoing, of course, but it makes it easier when we do them in blocks. And we're going to start as we continue. This is class actually 29. It's hard to believe. 29 class. And then we're up to almost the first Kaddish, as they would say. Up to Rabbi Yishmael Omer, that's what I want to focus on today. I'm not sure we'll finish it all today or not. Probably not. We usually don't finish what I think we might finish. And if not, next week. Even if we don't finish it, I don't want to spend more than 2 weeks on them. Then we'll get into Psukei Dezimra, Mizmor Shir. But this, of course, ends the first part of davening, Rabbi Yishmael Omer. And it's, of course, not typical. It's not like standard, like davening. This is really learning, as we've discussed a number of times. Can I pull the blind down behind me? Okay. You know what? I can sit in a different direction. Is this better? Thank you for that. Thank you for letting me know. I'm in somebody's office here in chat. So that's why the whole time changing. So, okay. Thank you. Okay. Let me know if you don't hear me well or something. Okay. As we know, our prayer book consists of not just like prayers, and the only prayer, we haven't mentioned this for a while, the only real prayer is the Amidah, is Ishmon Esrei. That's the only, everything else is introduction to prayer. Shema is not a prayer. Shema is an affirmation of faith. Psukei Dezimra is not a prayer. Psukei Dezimra are praises. It's not nice just to come in and ask God for everything we want. So we praise him a little bit, but that's less important. If you walk into Shul late, right? That's, I know I occasionally don't do that, or right? You walk into Shul late, so you skip Psukei Dezimra, so you can get to the Amidah with the congregation, because that's davening with the minyan means davening Amidah with the minyan. So you can skip that; it's less important, etc. Birchat Hashachar. So the only real prayer is Amidah, but there are, you know, gradations. We have learning because the rabbis understood not everybody's going to have time to learn. And so if you daven every day, you fulfill at least on a minimal level the mitzvah of Talmud Torah. We've spoken about this a little bit, and we have two cycles of learning. Learning has to consist of Tanakh, of biblical verses. It has to consist of Mishnah. That's how the rabbis understand that. Bishinantam. You should teach your children. The rabbis have a plain word, Bishilashtam. You should divide into three. And there are three sort of big areas of learning. One is the area of Tanakh. One is Mishnah. Mishnah doesn't mean the corpus that Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, the six orders of the Mishnah. I mean, it also means that. It means law, straight law without explanations. You do this, you don't do that. A sukkah has to be this tall, and the lulav has to be like this. That's Mishnah. Gemara, which you can have Mishnah in the Gemara, and Gemara is analysis, debate. So you have to do all three types of learning, analysis. And we did that two ways. The Birchat Kohanim, we say in the morning, right earlier, before Birchat Hashachar Yivarecha Hashem Yishmerecha. Then we have the Mishnah, Elu Dvarim She'en Lehem Shiur, things that have no measure, the more the merrier. HaPeya Bikurin Arayon Gvilu Chasadim Tamu Torah, right? Those Peya, the corner of the field, that's Mishnah. And then there's Gemara. Actually, it doesn't sound like Gemara so much. It sounds similar to the Mishnah, but Elu Dvarim She'avdam Ocham Porotem Bo'olam Hazeh. The things that we eat in this world, we have the fruit in this world, but the principles to the next world, kibud ha'ein, gilu chasadim, that's the first cycle. And then we have the second cycle of what we've been doing for the last many weeks, korbanot, the daily sacrifice. Prayer, of course, corresponds. It's not exactly replacement, it corresponds. So we say the korban tamid, which we spoke about, the daily sacrifice. Then we do the Mishnah, eizu makoman. That's what we finished our 3 weeks ago, and the korban pesach is one of the only chapters in the Mishnah with no debate, how the various sacrifices, that's Mishnah. Now today we're going to get the Gemara. And the more complicated, I don't know, complicated, but it's something people say, a lot of people say every day, and I don't, myself included, how many people have ever come across, you know, in other words, all these complicated rules, we don't seem to come across them too often. So we'll talk about that a little. Kal v'chomer we come across often. But a lot of these things, not so much. So that's what we'll do today. Rabbi Yishmael Omer v'shloshes v'ayim midot ha'Torah nidreshet. Rabbi Yishmael taught in 13 measures, 13 midah, right? 13, how do you translate the word midah? Midot means character traits, you know, the character of the Torah. Midah means a measurement, like a mathematical, you know, term. This is, you know, you go here and you don't go there. But there are 13 ways, or I think in English, the fancy word is hermeneutical principles, principles of interpretation of the Bible. Now, there's a lot to talk about here. This really is a shiur in Talmud Torah. So we'll try to highlight what I think some are the important points. And if you have any questions or comments, please let me know, either interrupt or put it in the in the chat box. So the first thing to just before we start, it's very interesting. How many Yishmaels do you know?
Yeah.
Don't know too many Yishmaels. Rav Yishmael, like the most, this is like the most famous. Who's the other one? Avram's son. I mean, right. Doug's brother, right? Okay, so you know, this is like the most famous piece. If you ask people how to interpret the Torah, well, obviously, because we say 365 days a year, so the most, and it's by Rabbi Yishmael. So that's really weird, no? So I don't really think it's weird. It's I don't, maybe there's some explanation I don't know about. I'm sure there is, but things change. It's a sociological comment. According to the rabbis, Yishmael did tshuva, and Yishmael was a good guy. And that's what the rabbis interpret by the funeral. Yishmael and Yitzchak come to bury Avram. And we know the Midrashim are very, listen, kach lecha et bincha et yechidcha asher ahavta et Yitzchak. Take your son, your only son, the one you love. And each one, as Rashi quotes, what do I mean? That's I love them both. They're both my only son. So God is saying, okay, Yitzchak. So Abraham was very close to Yishmael, and we know he didn't want to throw him out of the house. He wasn't going to do it. Just God told him, you have to listen to your wife. He was very, and the Midrashim portray that Abraham wanted to go back and get Yishmael, and the rabbis see Yishmael as somebody who's a good guy. You're going to tell me the descendants of Yishmael has caused us great problems. So that might be true. I don't know that that's relevant. I mean, it's you can say great, we can list off the Gedolim of the 19th century and list where their grandchildren were, and they're rolling over in their graves. Where, as I've mentioned many times, Mark Shapiro often points out, the Soloveitchik family, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik was the only one who kept all his kids observant. Every Gadol B'Yisrael, Rav Aaron Kotler, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, all of them had non-religious siblings. Some siblings who were, when I say non-religious, like I don't mean like they didn't daven Maariv with the minyan. I meant like they ate pork, you know, like that. I mean, I don't know exactly, but they were, Rav Aaron, I mean, it was very difficult to keep. So the fact that somebody's descendants are not great doesn't necessarily, especially if they're not alive, that there's no connection between the person who and the, you know, many generations later. But the more important point from a religious point of view is that according to the Ramban, according to Rabbi, it's almost painful. It's painful to say it's our fault. It's our fault. It's the Ramban. Maybe people disagree with the Ramban, but the Ramban. The Ramban basically says it's because of they threw him out of the house. They were punished the way they treated. It was Avram, why did we go down to Egypt? Because Avram lied about his wife. So he said, it's my sister, and they did not faith in God during the famine, all kinds of things. So the rabbis now, it's the same thing. The temple was destroyed of Sinat Chinam. The rabbis always like to look at internal issues. The rabbis are not saying the temple was destroyed because of Sinat Chinam. I mean, they say those words, but that's not what they mean. The rabbis mean when there's a disaster, we don't know why God does things. How can we know what they're not prophets. What mean they know? And the Talmud has about 8 different reasons why the Talmud was destroyed. As I mentioned last night, when they have 8 reasons for something, it means we don't know the reason at all. Sinat Chinam is the most famous reason. The rabbis were talking to their generation. That's what Midrash is. Midrash is talking to your generation. What are the lessons I can learn from what it says in the Torah? So the rabbis looked around and said, you know, there's a lot of internal dissension here. That's what we got to focus on. Now, it's true. Internal dissension weakens the society. That's make it easier to capture. So, but the rabbis were very harsh on the people. And maybe we don't like that, but the Ramban is. So I don't think you can blame the fact that what happens to Yishmael's descendants and the relationship with Gun, hopefully now with the Abraham Accords, it's actually a beautiful name. And that's really what it's all about, that the children of Abraham should come together in peace. That's our vision. So I think, and the word Yishmael, of course, is a very beautiful name. Yishmael, God hears, you know, it's a beautiful name. Obviously, for the last 2,000 years, no Jew, I don't recommend you name your kid Yishmael. I don't know, but I don't think there's anything wrong with it. That's the, so I just want to point, that's a total aside. Rabbi Yishmael Omer, B'shloshet Rimi Dor HaTorah Objection. So the next question to discuss is, what do I mean Rabbi Yishmael Omer? Did Rabbi Yishmael invent these midot? Or is he recording a tradition? This is a really a loaded question that we should spend another year on to analyze that question, because really that we can. If you want to, the best treatment of this, I believe in Hebrew, is Rav Amnon Bazak, a Rebbe in Gush Etzion, who wrote a phenomenal book, Nitzchuni Banai. It, as far as I know, it's not translated into English. My children have defeated me. That's the famous piece when Rabbi Eliezer says, if I'm right, the wall should come in, the stream should go backwards, a heavenly voice should come. And the rabbis say, Torah lo b'shamayim, Torah, I don't care what God has to say, Torah is not in heaven. And the next day, the Talmud says, they met Eliyahu Hanavi, whatever that means, and they ask Eliyahu, what was God doing? They're having a whole discussion, and Rabbi Eliezer is bringing proofs from God, and God's listening. He's moving the trees, making the water go backwards, the wall tumbling in, gives a heavenly voice. And Rabbi Yeshua says, I don't care, Torah lo b'shamayim, Torah is not in heaven, and we follow Rabbi Yeshua. Jewish law follows Rabbi Yeshua. And they said, what was he doing? So they answered, God was smiling. He was proud of his children. And he said, Nitzchuni Banai, Nitzchuni Banai. He said it twice. My children have defeated me. My children have defeated me. And of course, Netzach in Hebrew also means eternal. By making the Torah our Torah, and we interpreting divorced from God, that's how we make the Torah eternal, because we have to apply it to our life. So is Rabbi Yishmael making this up? Like, or is this something that existed before him and he's handing down a tradition from Sinai? He's just the one who says it, but obviously he didn't invent it up. So what do you think? Of course, you know what the question is. I'm sorry?
He didn't invent it.
So you're going to see that, I mean, so basically a question like that, the answer, whatever you say is right and whatever you say is wrong. In other words, it's a debate. There are, believe it or not, now, within our tradition, I guess, in general, there are, see, today, for historical reasons, you know, the Orthodox community is much more small C conservative than it used to be, because it's reactionary to reform, whatever. That's a historical discussion, but it's true. And because of that, things that, you know, used to happen all the time, people are afraid, maybe for good reason. I had the famous example, like from our world, so to speak, from the modern world, I mentioned a number of times, Rabbi Rekepet, when he first went to Russia, asked the KGB, put him up. They didn't let you stay Shabbos near the hotel. They weren't stupid, whatever. They put him up in some hotel, and he couldn't walk. So he asked Rav Soloveitchik, can he take a taxi with a non-Jew? It's a very easy halachic shaila. There's really, it's like playing an organ with a non-Jew. There's no halachic shaila that having a non-Jew play an organ in a shul on Shabbos can, I'm not saying it has to be, but can easily be justified according to halacha. That's very clear. And the halachic system. But halacha is not just a pure legal system. You do have to take into account the impact it has on society. The posek lives, it's a Torah Chaim, you're living in the world. So the organ became the symbol of those who were breaking away from our tradition. So it became taboo, even on a Tuesday night at a wedding, not just on Shabbat. And Rav Soloveitchik said he wants to think about it. And Rav Soloveitchik came back, said, I would love to allow it, but because of the conservative movement, I can't. He said, because people won't make the distinction. You went for the taxi. That was the heights of, you know, the bad conservative movement allowing driving. And you could argue, right or wrong, that's a sociological determination. But leaving that aside, within our tradition, there are great, great rabbis, some of the greatest rabbis, who say that the Binet Tziv is one example. Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, the great Rosh Yeshiva in Balashin, is an example of somebody. We're not going to go through all the sources here. That's, you know, this is still meant to be a thing on the Siddur. He's very radical in the ability of the rabbis to reinterpret. And I'm going to tell you now a thing in the Rambam that you'll see the Rambam probably also comes from this school of radical reinterpretation of we determining what the biblical law is. So there are people who say that Rabbi Shmuel basically meant, invented it. Invented may be too strong a word. He developed it. He developed it from Hillel. Rabbi Shmuel is not the first person to come up with principles how to interpret the Torah. Rabbi Shmuel is living in the second century. The Torah has been around a long time. And even if you want to argue till the end of the period of the prophets, you didn't need any interpretation. The prophets taught you what to do. It's probably true. The oral law only develops in the second temple period when there are no prophets anymore. But that's still a few hundred years. So we know Hillel had seven midot shehatorani freshet b'hem. Hillel had seven, and Rabbi Shmuel is taken. He develops a little bit more. Mainly in the area of klal uprat. You know, if you look in Rabbi Shmuel, anything that's a klal, it left the klal. It's part of the klal. We have about six or seven of them say klal uprat, prado klal, klal uprato klal, klal she kol davar shayav bichlal. So that's many of them were not in Hillel's original seven. Or shteik tuvim hamachshizim zed zed. My favorite. Two verses that contradict each other. That was not in Hillel's method of interpretation. So that's one school of thought that Rabbi Yishmael basically developed this. And the Netziv goes so far to say, maybe today we can't do that. We don't have a Sanhedrin. But even there, some people have room. You see every once in a while, a posek will give just an original interpretation of a verse in the Torah. Totally original to answer a lachik shaila. It's rare, but it happens. Once we have a Sanhedrin, they'll be very, very, very common. So there's sort of the one approach. And the second approach is no. The approach of many Rishonim was, what are you talking about? This is, that's why I say the two approaches to halakha in general, a very sort of, I don't know, a radical approach, but it's a very interpretive, the ability of the rabbis to change the method of interpretation. That's one approach the halakhic system took. And the second approach is no, everything that a Talmid Chacham says was given to Moshe in Har Sinai. There was a statement like that. Kol ma she-talmid vatik atid l'chadesh, whatever a student is going to say a new insight was already given to Moshe at Mount Sinai. Now, so the people who believe in the more interpretive tradition will interpret that Gemara, not in a literal sense. That's one thing. And then you have the other Gemara, just to give an example, you have the Gemara, Moshe Rabbeinu goes up to get the Torah, the famous Midrash, and God's finishing up the letters, the crowns, and Moshe, what are these crowns for? And God says, Rabbi Akiva, in 1500 years, is, but Moshe says, wow, can I meet this guy? I'm blown away. Famous story, the Gemara in Menachot, Rabbi Akiva goes to the Beit Midrash. Moshe goes to the Beit Midrash of Rabbi Akiva, and he doesn't understand one word. And he's all upset. Oh my God, they destroyed my Torah. And then finally somebody asked a question to Rabbi Akiva, and he gives an answer. He says, where do you know that? So Rabbi Akiva says, Halacha l'Moshe Misinai. This law was given to Moshe and Mount Sinai. Ah, Moshe felt great. Moshe didn't understand one word. He still didn't understand one word. But that's true. We know that in science. Galileo wouldn't understand how we made airplanes. Newton, you develop theories that come from Sinai, but they get developed in a way that the originator of the theory could never have been anticipated. So that's just in general, just to know that there's much more to discuss here, but that's by way of introduction. What I will say, and this is, I think, fascinating, the Rambam, you know, if I ask how many mitzvot are there in the Torah? So anybody from kindergarten pretty much knows there's 613 mitzvot in the Torah, 248 positive, 365 negative. What I think I've mentioned a number of times, what many of people also know, is we don't have a list of the six. The first list of the 613 mitzvot doesn't appear until the 8th century, a list that includes lighting the Hanukkah candles and reading the Megillah on Purim, a list the Rambam didn't like for that reason. About Bahagvah, there is no list. The problem is we've got 5 million mitzvot. What do you mean 613 mitzvot? On Shabbat alone, I've got 500 mitzvot. So obviously, a mitzvot, all the 39 milachot are considered one mitzvah. So every prohibition of Shabbat comes under one. Okay, so then you get to 613. So it's Yom HaTzma'ut this week, and on Thursday, really it's on Friday. This is the beauty of the Israeli government, the beauty of a quote-unquote, it's not a secular government, but quote-unquote, the people who claim it's a secular government, that this Friday is Hey-Er, but because of Shabbos, they're afraid it'll cause Chilul Shabbos, so the secular corrupt Israeli government decided to make Yom HaTzimut on Thursday so as not to violate Shabbos. And we know Yom HaTzimut never appears on Hay Iyar except when it's on a Wednesday. Because if it's going to be on a Monday, that means Yom HaZikaron runs on a Sunday, and they'll start preparing on Saturday before Shabbos. So they push off Yom HaZikaron a day. So the only time Yom HaTzimut is on Hay Iyar is when it's on a Wednesday. Anyway, this week, Baruch Hashem, Yom HaTzimut, 74 years old. And so there's a famous debate between the Rambam and the Ramban. Is living in Israel one of the 613 mitzvot? The Rambam says no. Now, that doesn't mean the Rambam didn't think it's important to live in Israel. The Rambam, clearly, you read his thought, he did think that. But he didn't think there's an obligation. It's not one of the 613 mitzvot. The Ramban attacks him very strongly. The Ramban attacks the Rambam. And the Megillat Esther defends the Rambam. Big debate. Is living in Israel considered one of the 613 mitzvot? We do not have an agreed-upon list of the 613 mitzvot. We have a consensus on 580 of them. I don't know. The Ramban and the Ramban disagree on 31 mitzvot. 17 negative, 14 positive. Like that's one living in Israel. The Ramban and the Rambam's list are 31 differences. Other list of other differences. But the most famous list is the list of the Rambam, followed by the Sefer HaChinuch. So the Rambam, like everybody, has a problem. I said, if I gave you, you know, Marty Lakshin just started a class on Mishpatim. If I gave you Parshat Mishpatim, and I told you, okay, tell me what are the mitzvot of the Taryag. It would be so hard to do. What counts as a mitzvah? What isn't? I've never done this. Give somebody, you know, hear the Torah, read it. Okay, figure out the 613 mitzvot. It's really, really hard. So you need to have ground rules. So the Rambam has 14 ground rules. That's this introduction to the Sefer HaMitzvot, which is an introduction to the Mishnah Torah. The Mishnah Torah, the Rambam's code of Jewish law, is really a elaboration of the 613 mitzvot in the Torah. So he first writes what the 613, and that's why in every time when the Rambam starts laws, he'll tell you how many mitzvot. The laws of belief, there are 10 mitzvot. The laws of idolatry, there are 51 mitzvot. The laws of prayer, there are 2 mitzvot. The laws of Talmud Torah, there are 2, and he lists them. And he says, and the explanation of these mitzvot are in the following chapters of the Mishnah Torah. So really, the Mishnah Torah, the Rambam's great work on Jewish law, is an elaboration of the 613 mitzvot. So he had to write an introductory book. What are the 613 mitzvot? And before he wrote that, he had to tell you, well, how do I figure out what's a mitzvah and what's not? So the first rule the Rambam has, which is this attack on the Mahag, is anything that's a rabbinic mitzvah can't count. It's got to be given to Moshe at Har Sinai. So Hanukkah candles can't count. What's the Bahag's argument? No, Lotus, or you got to listen to the rabbis. That's not for now. And rule number 2 of the Rambam is you cannot count anything that is derived from the Yud Gimel Midot of Rabbi Shmuel. Anything that we derive in the Torah based on these 13 principles doesn't count. It doesn't mean we don't have to do it. Right? There are many things, but it doesn't count as a mitzvah. Question is why? So why? Well, we'd have 5 million mitzvot if we did count it. But of course, what's the philosophical understanding of that? Why is it that anything comes from the Yud Gimel Midot cannot be counted as a mitzvah? Why not?
God didn't say that.
Okay, that's the simple answer. God didn't say it. Right. It's by the way, that there even are 613 mitzvot in the Middle Ages was a debate. Today, everybody learns it in kindergarten. But the Ramban is not so sure. The Gemara never gets excited about 613 mitzvot. It's mentioned twice in passing. The Gemara never dwells on it. The famous piece, only once in the Talmud, the end of in the second Makot, Rav Simlai says there's 613. It's an agadic, a non-legal piece. And the Gemara, that's where the Gemara says, and King David came along and said, 613 is too hard, we'll make 11. And Yishayahu said, we'll make 3 and 6. And Micha said, we'll make 3. And Chababuk said, we'll make 1. Tzadik be'emunato yichya. A tzadik lives through his faith. So you see already this is a piece that's not exactly a legal piece in the Talmud. So the Ramban question, maybe they're not 613 mitzvot. He doesn't know. But he says Jewish tradition has accepted the view they're 613 mitzvot. Let's find them. But so it wasn't said by God. So that Gemara is introduced. Taryag mitzvot nemru, the Moshe, they were said by God to Moshe at Har Sinai. That's why the Ramban says you can't count a rabbinic mitzvah. So Zev is adding the Yud Gimel Midot also wasn't said by God. They're implied. They're found within the Torah, but man has to research. So they're excellent. Very good. I would add that the Rambam is of the, as we all know, one of the basic tenets of quote unquote orthodoxy for sure of the Rambam theology is the Torah can never change. The Torah can never ever change. That means the mitzvot can never change. The problem is the Yud Gimel Midot can change all the time. A Sanhedrin, one court can rule Klalu Pradu Klal this way, and the next court can come along 50 years later and rule it differently and undo a mitzvah based on their interpretive powers. We don't see that anymore because we don't have a Sanhedrin. But when it's clear in the Talmud all the time, and we have it all the time, Mishnah Rishona, the first stage is set X, and the next stage is said, no, why? We're going to do, no, we don't agree. That's not a mitzvah. And left and right, and it can change. And it is possible once we get a Sanhedrin. How do we know there are 39 melachot on Shabbat? They're not written anywhere in the Torah. Oh, Korah writes Mishkan, building the Mishkan next to it. Who says that's the only interpretation? So today, that's the halachic interpretation. And that's what we have to do. And I'm not saying, no, you know, for sure, we have to do it. It's beautiful. But when, please God, we'll have a Sanhedrin in the not too distant future. I don't know when exactly, but it can happen. And it's less miraculous than having a state of Israel. Maybe it's more miraculous getting rabbis all together. I don't know. And if the Sanhedrin, a real Sanhedrin with real smicha, decides, you know what? We think Hilchot Shabbos should be interpreted differently. They have not only the right, they have the obligation to interpret. Rav Schachter, you know, I quote Rav Schachter a lot. I was in his shir for four years. I owe a lot of my knowledge to him. He was an unbelievable person. I was in his shir before he was famous in the 1980s, and I was blown away by his knowledge. And he's very friendly. I know some of his sort of persona and some of the positions he's taken. I cringe at some of the positions he's taken, but he's an unbelievable person. He's such a friendly person and a warm person. And anyway, got a great sense of humor. And so Rav Schachter, all the time, he was very into this idea that the Torah develops and every Beit Din has the right theology. I mean, that's basically what Rav Moshe Feinstein writes, not on the Taryag Mitzvot level, but on a halachic level. The Igrot Moshe, Rav Moshe Feinstein, the greatest halachic authority who ever stepped foot in North America, wrote in his introduction that I'm going to disagree with people who are greater than me. I'm going to disagree with the Chatam Sofer, and I'm going to disagree with the Novi Huda. And not only am I allowed to, I'm obligated to, because Ein Lechacham Ela Mashe Navroot. Once you reach a level that you're entitled to an opinion, Rav Schachter used to tell us that all the time, not so many people are entitled to an opinion. Most people, but if you're entitled to an opinion, or Moshe Feinstein was surely entitled to an opinion, you don't have to be on the same level. You have to stay. The halacha is, I've mentioned this many times, lo tagur mipnei ish. You're not allowed to be afraid of anybody. That's a rule on the judge. That's one of the 613 mitzvot. Everybody agrees. Do not be afraid. A judge on a court, but beyond the judge, you cannot be afraid of people. And as Rav Schachter always used to tell us, Rav Yosef Karo was also an ish. Rav Yosef Karo, the author, he was also an ish. If you're convinced, Rav Soloveitchik would say, got this from Rav Soloveitchik, you didn't make this up. It's a Brisker whole tradition. The Brisker tradition is very independently learning. That's how Rav Chaim can invent a new way, develop a new way of learning, because they were very independently minded. And, you know, if you're convinced that the Shulchan Aruch, if I'm convinced the Shulchan Aruch is wrong, so I'm an idiot. But if Rav Soloveitchik is convinced the Shulchan Aruch is wrong, so he has an obligation to rule against what it says in the Shulchan Aruch. You'll ask five other rabbis, you know, maybe the Shulchan Aruch didn't. It's true. We've now discovered manuscripts. We've discovered new things that will impact on the halakha. So now I think the Shulchan Aruch would be different. That's, or you can believe as well, interpretation is wrong. So that's a style of learning. And that's how Rav Moshe Feinstein, that's his introduction to the Igrot Moshe. And if you know anything about Rav Moshe Feinstein, he never backed down from his position. I'm here in chat, you know, I've mentioned, so I teach a course now, and I'm going to be teaching at 10:45, a course I'm teaching, just started this week, Contemporary Halakha, great 12 course. I love the course. And, you know, the kids were asking me about artificial insemination. Somehow it came up this week. So Rav Moshe Feinstein has the famous response to that. You're allowed to take the sperm of not your husband and implant it in the woman. And he was savagely attacked for that, as you can imagine. imagine. This is adultery. But Moshe stood his ground. He's not backing down. And that's the great, great poskim are not afraid of anybody. That's what makes them great poskim. So it's sort of abuse. Anyways, that's a very long introduction. But this idea of Rabbi Yishmael, did Rabbi Yishmael invent him? How much room do you give for the modern day, maybe, or at least the Sanhedrin, to interpret the tradition is not clear. There are debates. And like I said, if your Hebrew is well, I mean, I'm sure there's stuff in English. I can't think off the top of my head where there's a good English discussion of this book. But Rav Amnon Bazak in his book, Nitzchuni Banai, he's a current Rebbe in Yeshivat Har Etzion, is a fantastic work where he develops, I think the subtopic of the book is, inyanim, you know, difficulties in the understanding of Torah Shavuot. And he goes through when the Gemara says, "Oh, the Mishnah means this," and you read the Mishnah, say, "What do you mean the Mishnah means that? That's not what the Mishnah says." The Gemara reinterprets the Mishnah. Does the Gemara really believe that's what the Mishnah means, or is the Gemara saying, "Well, our halacha"? By the way, this is based on the Vilna Gaon. Of just this last example, the Vilna Gaon was the one who came up with this, the great Vilna Gaon. So very often, for those who have learned Talmud, you'll know what I mean. And for don't, I hope I'm clear enough. If I'm not clear enough, please let me know. But very often, the Mishnah says X, and the Gemara will say, "Oh, the Mishnah is only talking about this like far fetched case, like that comes up once in a thousand." But the Mishnah didn't mean that, and any modern person who reads the Mishnah, is that really what the Mishnah means? That's not what the Mishnah says. But that's how the Gemara interprets it. So the Vilna Gaon, no less a personage than the Vilna Gaon, said, of course the Gemara knew that's not what the Mishnah means. But the Gemara has the right to disagree with the Mishnah. But they didn't want to come out, and this is not nice to disagree with Rabbi Akiva, with Rabbi Yishmael. So Abaye is going to disagree with Rabbi Akiva. So what they did is they said, you know what? I could even interpret the Mishnah in a way that works with the halacha today. Now, maybe today we find that strange because that's not the way we operate. But in the time of the, when you have a deep, deep respect for our tradition, and even when you're disagreeing, so you want to say, you know, I don't have to really disagree. Maybe they meant this crazy case. Okay, they didn't really mean it. But the fact that I can read into it, so that's how the Vilna Gaon explains when the Gemara gives these wild explanations that seem to be very different. I think it's unfortunate. Not enough people, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong. Not enough people sort of actually know this. So the Rebbe teaches some kid, the Rebbe teaches, and he tells the kid, that's what the Gemara, and the kids say, "What are you crazy?" And the kid argues with the Rebbe, and the Rebbe gets upset at the kid. "What are you arguing with the Gemara? You heretic, you have before," you know. So it can be a big turnoff to religion for some kids. A serious kid who's a thinking kid says, "What are we talking about?" But we follow the Gemara's ruling, because we always follow the later day authorities in halakha. That's also part of this whole system. If a modern, the halacha, because the later authority has taken everything before him and builds on it. So the halacha kibbutz right. That's a basic principle. We don't say, "Oh, the Rambam." I care what the Rambam says. We base on the Rambam. But if Rav Moshe Feinstein, based on other people, says we don't follow the Rambam, we don't. The Mishnah Berurah changes. I've mentioned the Mishnah Berurah changes the psak of the Shulchan Aruch all the time. The Rav Yosef Kar said, "Hey, the Mishnah Berurah does it in a very firm way. You know, he sounds very firm when he does it. You know, well, the Eliyahu Rabbah says this, and this one says this, so we should be strict." But he's changing the law of the Shulchan Aruch all the time. We always follow the later day authorities. That's how halakha works. So we follow the Gemara's interpretation of the Mishnah. I think I mentioned once before the cute story that apparently a number of years ago, bunch of students, I don't know, a bunch, the way I heard the story, who knows if it's true, they went, I imagine there's a little truth to it, they went to Rav Amital, the Rosh Yeshiva, the family Rosh Yeshiva, Yeshiva Har Etzion, and they said, "We want to learn Mishnah, there is to learn Mishnah independently from the Gemara." There is a whole school of thought, and that does go on today with serious people. "We're going to learn the Mishnah divorced from the Gemara." That's there in the Middle Ages. This was done by a great rabbi. The Mishnah is a separate subject from the Gemara. And let's understand the Mishnah on its own terms. Then there's the way how the Gemara understands the Mishnah. So we want to do that. Rabbi Amital said, "You see that hill over there? You set up your own yeshiva. In this yeshiva, we follow what the Gemara says. That's our approach." And that's the approach of Jewish. And I don't think they were necessarily saying they would follow it in Jewish law. They were just saying. So anyways, it's a cute story. Okay, let's discuss some of the 13 principles. You see, if I go through all 13, we're going to be here for 52 weeks, but we won't. We'll go so pretty quickly. Okay. So now, where does this teaching of Rabbi Shmuel appear? So some say, what's it doing? Why did the rabbis pick this? Why did the rabbis pick this teaching? Right? This is in the Siddur because we have to learn a little more. So why did they pick this learning? So I don't know exactly. So what many people explain, I don't know if it's it's a nice thing. I don't know if it's a knockout reason. It's because this piece of Rabbi Shmuel, the source of it is not her Siddur, right? Of course, the Siddur picked it up from the introduction of the Sifra, the Torah Kohanim, the Midrashic commentary on Sefer Vayikra that talks about the Korbanot. And that's, so this is the introduction to that book, to that Midrash. So it fits in very well. We just finished Korbanot. Prayer is related to Korbanot. So this ties into the theme, even though the 13 principles are not talking about Korbanot, it's talking about Torah in general. That's why it was picked. It's also probably picked because I don't know, it's a more intensive Torah sort of class, whatever, Torah, you know, ideas. And we want people to know what are the rules of how to interpret Torah. You can't just do whatever you want. So okay, let's try to go through some of them. By the way, I'll point out another fascinating discussion, debate between, you know, Rabbi Ishmael's contemporary was, just, you know, let's get some audience participation. Who was Rabbi Ishmael? His chavruta, so to speak, his bar plukta. Who was Rabbi Shmuel's main rabbinic contemporary?
Not Rabbi Eliezer, no.
I mean, you know, they lived. Listen, Rabbi Shmuel is from the generation of Yavne. That's that. He's one of the, you know, that great generation we read about at the Pesach Seder, you know, in Bnei Brak. And, you know, Rabbi Eliezer ben Azariah and Gamliel and Rabbi Yoshua, that's that, you know, amazing generation. They're the people who established the Mishnah. They're the ones who really got Jewish law rolling, so to speak. So, but Rabbi Shmuel is the one he debates the most is Rabbi Akiva. It's none other than Rabbi Akiva. And they had a fundamental different approach to halakha, which also lends why some people say that Rabbi Shmuel developed these themes. Because Rabbi Akiva doesn't accept the principle of kol uprat. Rabbi Akiva has a different principle, ribui b'miut. It sounds very, ribui is expansive, and miut is to make less. And it's a different way to interpret the Torah. And very often, Rabbi Ishmael and Rabbi Akiva argue on how to interpret Torah based on their methodology of how do we, what principle do we use? So Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Ishmael had different interpretive methods. What's most famous, but most sort of interesting is we know Rabbi Akiva yadoresh kol kutz v'kutz, right? Et, right? The famous Gemara, Rabbi Akiva would analyze every et. Rabbi Akiva felt there was something special in every letter, even in the crowns of the letters. So Moshe Rabbeinu goes to the Beit Midrash of Rabbi Akiva, because Rabbi Akiva, God told Moshe, is expounding on the crowns. Rabbi Akiva saw every line of the Torah of great significance. As Rav Schachter told us once, we do not have one law that we know of that was derived from the crowns of the Torah. You cannot name one law that was derived from the crowns of the Torah. This famous story that Moshe Rabbeinu wanted to see Rabbi Akiva expounding on the crown Torah, we don't have one law. Because Rabbi Ishmael had a very different principle of Jew. Rabbi Ishmael did not believe that. He did not believe every et was important. Divra Torah kilashon ne adam. The Torah speaks in the language of man. And people, we're not so exacting in our words. The Torah is for man. We don't have to look at every, oh my God, what an extra F is going to, come on, get out of here. That's how people speak. This debate here plays out in halakha and how you understand Jewish law. This debate plays out in the Middle Ages in Parshanut, Hamikra. Do we, the Ibn Ezra, for it? So the story the servant finding a wife for Yitzchak is repeated, and there are 20 differences. It doesn't matter. Even the differences, the Ibn Ezra says, it's almost shocking, almost shocking. The Ibn Ezra will say, you know, the differences in Ten Commandments, Zachor, Shomer, no big deal. No big deal. When you repeat the same story twice, you're not going to say word for word the exact thing. So this is, The Chama Leibowitz couldn't stand that approach, especially even if you want to accept Rabbi Shmuel, she couldn't take that approach of like the Ibn Ezra and that, no big deal. That's how people speak. You don't have to look at every letter in the Torah. She said, you're missing so much. We were all trained in the idea that every letter in the Torah, you know, they're fine. And maybe that's true on a parshanut level, but on expounding on commentary, but within the halakhic school, it is far from certain that that's true. And Rabbi Yishmael, whose 13 midot we have accepted, not Rabbi Akiva, we don't take Rabbi Akiva's midot. Rabbi Yishmael, as we follow, is very clear, divrat Torah kol shom bnei adam. Don't get too excited about extra letters in the Torah, extra word. They may at times, but they don't necessarily give a new halakhic interpretation. That's just a fascinating thing. Again, something, you know, our tradition, I would like to say it's more, I don't know what the word is, pluralistic. It's more, it's much wider. There are many more beautiful opinions. It's a, you know, different approaches to how Torah is meant to be understood. And we don't do enough of that sort of understanding how the Torah is meant, how the halakhic process works. Because and part of it is, I think, because of reform and conservative reaction, the fear to do something new because it looks too radical. It doesn't feel from, you know, and if we do it, it's going to look bad. If we allow going at a tax, it's the same thing, by the way, Rabbi Riskin. You heard from him directly. He was working with a community to that, you know, the shul, like a lot of cities, the Jews moved in the suburbs and the shul is still in the downtown area, you know, the 50s, 60s, 70s, and it's too expensive. They didn't build a new shul yet, whatever. So people weren't so religious. They were driving to the shul in downtown and they lived in the suburbs. So Rabbi Riskin was working with them and, you know, making him more observant, whatever. So he came up with the idea. He called it a sabbas. You know, a transport bus, a Shabbat. You get a non-Jewish driver, like a Shabbos elevator. You set it up before it, just it stops automatically. You get on.
You want to check for the Rita?
I'm sorry? Are you asking? If you're not asking a question, if you're asking a question, great. Otherwise, please mute yourself. But so Rabbi Riskin will come up with like a Shabbos elevator, a Shabbos, a bus that stops. And people will get on the bus and get a lift to shul. They don't have to drive. A great idea. Phenomenal idea. So he went to Rabbi Soloveitchik, same thing. And Rabbi Soloveitchik gave him the same answer. It's a great idea. I would like to allow it. I can't. The conservative movement. No, you can disagree. You don't like it. I can't allow it today. The communal battles overrode. Maybe it's tragic. Maybe it's sad. And I assume Rabbi Soloveitchik felt it was tragic and sad. He just probably felt he didn't have a choice. So halacha works in the real world. You know, it's not, there's the abstract halacha, the theoretical halacha, and then there's halacha practice. So it's important at least we be aware of the theoretical halacha, whether we can apply it in practice. So that we'll have to see. Okay, let's do at least the first two of the midot, and then maybe, okay. So, okay, so, and I guess, you know, I'll say related to this, we have, when we say a midrash and we expound on the midrash, we say because the laws of Shabbat are the idea to keep Shabbat is written next to the Mishkan. So whatever was necessary for the Mishkan, that's what you can't do on Shabbat. Is that beforehand? Was that true? Was that only, in other words, is this what we call in the terminology of our rabbis? Is that a midrash yotzer or a midrash mikayim? Does that midrash create the halacha? Or does that midrash affirm the halacha? What we call an asmachta. They knew the law before. They had a tradition dating down from Mount Sinai. And they just looked for a verse to hang the law on. So this is, again, a major debate. We have asmachtas, for sure. But when the rabbis make these midrashim, Kavah Chomer, Gzeir Shavah, is it true that before they made the Gzeir Shavah, they compared two words, that law didn't exist? Or no... And they're creating the law. The Midrash creates the law or no? The law existed. And this is a much more conservative approach. This is what we've been talking about. So that's the same way, obviously, as you can imagine. This is a major debate among commentaries throughout the ages. Some say the Midrash creates the law before the Midrash. I'll give you one great example, at least in this theory. And some say, no, the law pre-existed, was given to Moshe at Mount Sinai. And they just looked for ways to fit it into the verses. But the verse doesn't really tell us that law. The verse is just used. So that's a major bit. I won't get into the pros and cons of each side, but we're coming up to the holiday of Shavuot. So Simi Peter is giving a great class on Megillat Rut, Mondays at 1 p.m. But so we know Ruth, David's great-grandmother. Ruth, how can Ruth become Jewish? She's a Moabite. Torah says, Lo yavo amoni amoavi b'kal Hashem, a Moabite and an Ammonite. Kanakam al-dvar sher likudu adchem b'lechem. They didn't give you bread in the desert. How can Ruth convert? We're not allowed to accept her. So what's the answer?
Moavit
v'lo Moavit. Men are not good. Loyavo Moavi. Moavi below Moavi. Do you think that's what the Torah meant? Or did they create a new law? That's when he asked the question, don't ask the question like that. That's too dangerous a question. What happened before Ruth? Was this law, the law always existed, but we didn't know. It took in the time of Boaz, it took, and remember, nobody wanted to marry Ruth because they felt, what are you talking about? Moavi? What do you mean, Yisrael? We're going to say Yisrael, the Ber Bnei Yisrael, Yisrael below Yisraelit? Really? That what it means? When by the Ber Shem Moshe Lemur, the Ber Bnei Yisrael, that's only the men of Israel? What are you talking about? It's men and women. Moavi below, Moavi, that's all, nobody. Until they made this new note, Moavi below. Now, what was their rationale? It's interesting. Now, the makes it more complex. The rationale was the share Loki do a temple. They didn't give you bread or water when you were in the
that's so nice. Thank you so much.
So mute yourself, that would be good. I'm not sure who's talking, but okay. So they didn't give you bread and water. So the Gemara says, who goes out to war to give supplies? Only men do that. So it means it's talking about the men. From the rest of the Pasuk, it's only talking about the men. This is the famous comment of the Satmar Rebbe. The Satmar Rebbe said that my uncle told me this. The Satmar Rebbe had a great sense of humor. The Satmar Rebbe probably didn't say this as a sense of humor. He probably meant this. He said when the Israeli government wanted to draft women into the army, he said, no, if they draft women into the army, you cannot give the reason that the women don't go out to fight, which is what they said by Ruth. Only men go out. So it was the men who didn't give the bread. So therefore, we don't accept the men convert, but we can accept the women. But now if the Israeli government drafts women to the army, so it means women go out. So it means Ruth's conversion is ipso facto invalid. Like, so it goes on today, we're going to invalidate her conversion. That goes on. You know, that rabbi was, so if her conversion is no good, we don't have King David anymore. That's it, the end of Jewish history. So that's what the Sefer Rebbe said about drafting women in the army. No, other people say other things. But
Rabbi Kelman.
Yes.
Pikuach nefesh duche Shabbat.
Yeah. Okay. That's this
is part. Yeah, but is it from the Tkufa of the Maccabim when...
So it could be, right. So that's only in the Tkufa of the Maccabees that they came up with this law that Pikuach Nefesh is Dochei Shabbat. So that's the question. What happened before the Maccabim? Is it that the law, it's like in science. When we discover gravity existed before Newton, right? Or Galileo. Well, you know, the Earth revolved around the sun before Copernicus. Right. We just didn't know that. So it could be that Sunday thought we didn't. There was no need to discuss it. We didn't break our heads. We didn't figure it out. Now it came war. There was a war. We got to figure out. Oh, you know what? Hey, we didn't realize that. So always Pikuach Nefesh was Docheh Shabbos. We just didn't know. So that's one way. And the other way is no. Pikuach, until the rabbis gave that law, Pikuach Nefesh was not Docheh Shabbos. So this is now it can be both. It can be somewhere like this, somewhere like that. But this is a fundamental debate. But I'm bringing the case of Ruth because Rav Schachter told us that he quoted the Chida Chaim Yosef David Azulai, the great 18th century world traveler who wrote 75 books and he visited all the communities around the world. He was the shaliach of Hebron. He lived, I think, in Hebron, went collecting money for the yeshuv in Hebron. The Chida, in one of his books, writes that. Let's say somebody converted 50 years before Ruth. Let's say a woman went to the Beitin, a Moabite woman, and the Beitin converted her. Would that conversion have been valid? So if you tell me the law, the Torah means a male and not a female, of course the conversion is valid. The fact that I didn't know the law until 100 years later, but that was always the law. I just didn't know it. So the conversion is valid. But the Chida says, no, that conversion is invalid. Because 50 years before Ruth, 1 year before, until the Beit Din came up with that ruling, Moavi, below Moavi, Ruth, you weren't allowed to accept a Moabite woman. When the court interpreted the verse to mean a male and not a female, only that's Mikanu Lahaba from here on end. So now she's Jewish. It's an amazing thing. It's a wild idea, right? This is the tension. This is the whole debate. There's no answer, obviously. I just want to make you aware of it to think how do the rabbis derive things from the Torah? But the Chida, that's Rav Shechter taught, that was his understanding, that it was only from then on. Before that, before the rabbis came up with this, the drasha, the rule was a woman could not convert Moabite woman. Now a woman can. So it's wild. The more conservative approach, small c conservative approach, that the halakha was always there. We're just discovering the halakha, like in science. We're not inventing the halakha. Yes. So they would say, of course it was good. Now, maybe 50 years ago, they would have said no good. But now we found out, oh, we were wrong. So, you know, the Supreme Court realized they made a mistake. So now we have to go back and correct all our mistakes. Anyway, so that's just a fascinating idea. Okay, let's very quickly. I see we're running late, like we tend to do, because I talk too much. But okay, I'll just point out. The first two midot, Kal Vachomer and Gzeirah Shavah, as you hopefully understand, are contradictory. What do I mean they're contradictory? A Kal Vachomer, what's a Kal Vachomer? That's the first of the Yud-Gimel midot. Kal Vachomer means to the light, to the heavy. It's a logical argument. If Shabbos is more important than Yontif, right? We know that the laws of Shabbat are stricter. We can't cook. So if something is permitted on Shabbat, Kal Vachomer is for sure permitted on Yontif. And if something is forbidden on Yontif, Kal Vachomer, if it's forbidden on Yontif, Kal Vachomer, it's forbidden on Shabbat, because Shabbat is more strict than Yontif. That's a Kal Vachomer. What do you need to do a Kal Vachomer? What kind of a tradition do you need to do a Kal Vachomer? None. You need a brain. Kal Vachomer, you need no tradition. It's a logical argument. The Gemara often has the expression Yehuda v'od likra. The Gemara will sometimes say a law, make a Kal Vachomer, and then they'll quote a verse to say the same thing. The Gemara says, "What do I need a verse for? V'od likra. What do I need a verse for? It's a logical argument. I don't need a verse to tell me that. I can figure that out on my own. The verse must be telling me something else." Because if it's a Kal Vachomer, it's obvious. I don't need any verses in the Torah for that. So a Kal Vachomer is a purely logical argument. We'll get back to some of the rules of Kal Vachomer. Not every argument, but it's a logical argument that you compare two cases. So how do you apply the law from one to the other? What's a Gzeirah Shavah? Gzeirah Shavah is the same idea. You're applying the law in one case to another. They're both taking a law from A and applying to B. You write Kal Vachomer, the law on Shabbat applies on Yontif. Right? What's a Gzeirah Shavah? A Gzeirah Shavah is that two words appear. It's what today it's very cool. It's modern literary analysis. The same word appears in two different contexts of the Bible. A word that's not sort of part of the, you know, he spoke to him, like obviously, a word that's sort of unusual, a word that we can understand the verse without that word. So two words appear. This word, the same word appears to, why? We want a hint. We want a hint that the same law that applies over here applies over there. What's one of the most famous? There are lots of Gzeirah Shavah. We can pick up on this hopefully next week. What's one famous Gzeirah Shavah? When you get married. How do you get married? The man gives the woman a ring. Harayat Mikudeshli. Where in the Torah does it say? I mentioned last night in my parshas here. Those were here. Kikach Ishi Shubala. The Torah only talks about living together as a method of marriage. That's how you get married. You went and you lived together. You moved in together. You set up a home. You're married. That's what the Torah taught. But the rabbi said, don't do that unless you make a ceremony first. That's the whole debate. If a couple who lives together, that's a huge debate. Not for now. Are they considered married? Or Moshe Feinstein, Rav Henkin. So how come the man gives the wife a ring? Very good. Because the word ki yikach ish isha, when a man takes, what do you mean he takes a woman? So that word, it's not actually the same word. When Abraham buys a plot for Sarah, it says he took the field from Ephron Hachiti. Kicha, kicha, miste Ephron. Kicha, kicha, the word kicha is said by marriage, and the word kicha by the field of Ephron. The same way Abraham paid a lot of money. But to get married, you only need a pruta. He paid 400 shekels. So that we don't learn. We don't learn the amount of money, interesting. We just learn the concept of money. So the same way he acquired the field with money, so too you get married with money. And we all do that. And the Rambam says we dafka do that. We want to show the power of the rabbis. We want to show that what the rabbis interpret, that's the essence of Torah. So that's how we all get married. It's not written in the Torah anywhere. Torah never said you can get married through money. It's this indirect Gzeira Shavah. Now, Gzeira Shavah is very dangerous. That's why the rabbis have a tradition. You have to have a tradition to make anybody can make up anything they want. So how far do you carry this? So we'll have to wait on that. I'll just end with the beautiful comment of Shri Shimon Rafael Hirsch. Every law has an ethical teaching behind it. Every law has a philosophy on it. Not just laws. That's not how we live our life. That's not Judaism. What's the Gzei Rashab teaching us? So Rav Shimon Hirsch beautifully says, the Torah says when you get married, you take care of your wife till after she dies. Marriage is till death do us part. I guess that's, you know, in the movies, whatever. I don't know if they really say that in the Christian ceremony, right? You know, we declare to be man and wife till death do us part, that you get married. Yeah, the way we get married is the way we bury the person. The love of the spouses has to carry beyond the grave. It's a beautiful, I think, a beautiful idea. The Gzeira Shavah is not just a legal technique. It's a more, why does the Torah do it this way? Because the Torah wants to teach us a moral lesson. Okay, let's very quickly review what we learned. So next time you go to a bris and they ask your opinion on a name, you can recommend Yishmael. Now, one of the greatest rabbis in Jewish history had a name Yishmael. Probably you won't get invited when they have the next bris. They probably won't be invited. What happens. But okay, we discuss why Yishmael and why it doesn't matter what his kids said. Yishmael is viewed in rabbinic literature as a good guy in the end. Maybe he had some negative things, but he did tshuva. It's even greater. Somebody asked me about Esav. Yes, Esav, the rabbis say Esav was a great guy to his parents. And Esav doesn't try to kill Yaakov. He kisses him. Different interpretations. Yes, it's more complex than the way they teach us in grade four that Esav is evil, Yaakov is great. Yaakov wasn't so great. He did things that weren't so right. Even they're 100%. The Torah is more complex than we like to present it. Okay. So we discussed the Divrei Torah Kashon Bnei Adam. Do we analyze every word? And then the main thing we focused on is what does it mean? Did he invent these things or was it a tradition given to Sinai? That same thing. Do you invent the law based on these threshold or the law existed? We're just using the verses as a way to come, you know, to put the law that we already know exists. And this is a very important debate, obviously. And I explained the view of the Rambam. I didn't finish really with the view of the Rambam. Okay, I'll pick up on that next week. I just explained where the Rambam says the mitzvot of Torah, he doesn't count one of the 613 principles because it's not mentioned in the Torah. We'll discuss a little bit more why hopefully next week. But that's really fundamental. Or when Ruth converts, is that a new interpretation? That's not what the Torah meant up there, but that's what God wants us. God gave us the Torah. We have to interpret the Torah, and every generation interprets it, and we can interpret it. Not what the Torah means, whatever we say it means. I mean, don't quote me on that out of context. You know, whatever great rabbis who are learned and pious and care deeply on the Jewish people, the Torah means what they say it means, and they can prove it. They have to write an analysis, you know, but, or no, the Torah is totally sealed. Anything a Talmud says was given to Moshe, and we're just uncovering it, like in science. Science is fixed. We just uncover science, right? We don't can't invent science. Nature doesn't change. It's actually, if you think about it that way, it gives us a whole new understanding, right? But so is Torah really we're creating Yesh Me'ayin, which is the more, believe it or not, the more traditional view. The Chatam Sofer, the Chazon Ish held like that, the Vilna Gaon, and many great people held this view that the Torah is very dynamic. We today may not have that permission, so we don't see it that way. But the Torah is very dynamic and very within the sage's ability to change it as we move forward. Okay, and then we discussed, we introduced Kal Vachomer, Gzeira Shavah, why this is part. This is introduction to the Torah Kohanim, the Korbanot. That's probably why it's doing in our Seder. And then we discussed the sort of opposites. The Kal Vachomer and the Gzeira Shavah are two different ways, one very logical. One today, it's what we call literary analysis, but one more, gotta be careful, the Gzeira Shavah comparing verses. Please God, we'll pick up next week, and then we'll finish. We'll go through. We won't do each one of the 13. It'll take us too long. I do want to get to the Siddur, you know, Sukkot Zimra, et cetera. But we'll spend, you know, some more time on this, especially my favorite two verses in Torah that contradict each other. The 13th principle of Rabbi Shmuel. Okay. Thank you for coming. Everybody have a wonderful, wonderful. wonderful Shabbat. Menachem Liebtag, 11:15 on Sunday morning. Simi Peters at 1 p.m. on Monday. Tuesday, Malka Simkowitz at 2 p.m. And then at 8 p.m., Michelle Chesner. 8 p.m. two new classes starting on Tuesday. Watch for the emails, and we look forward to learning with you. Just let me see very quickly, are there any questions or comments in the chat box? Was Asaph at his father's funeral, right? I referred to that. Yes, he was. He conceptualized the way Torah was learned and applied. I'm not sure who, Tova, you're referring to. You can tell me. It's a derivation, so perhaps open to debate as error or opposed to a clear Torah mitzvah. Again, I'm not sure what you're referring to. At what point that was said. What's a derivation? Root? Okay, please let me know. Rabbi Akiva, yes, correct. Heavenly Torah by H.A. Heschel. Okay, explores these two approaches. Okay, thank you very much, Yocheved. I was not aware. I'm not aware of Heschel's book. Is that the book? Torah Baspaklaria Shomaler or something. I don't know if that's a translation. But okay, I have to read it. Okay, thank you. Pikuach Nefesh Tocha Shabbos from the time of the Maccabim, as we discussed, correct? Is everyone buying land to bury Sarah, right? So now dot Torah by fiat, what the Torah means. Right, obviously this approach is, right, dot Torah, you know, is basically assumed to be a modern invention. It's not the way Torah ruling. You can't, listen, there's a famous story, Rav Chaim Brisker, who was a great innovator, right? Always new approaches, right? This new innovative approach. Rav Shachter, Rav Soloveitchik, that's where it's all coming from, this school of innovation. So Rav Chaim Brisker once sent a question, Rav Zevin quotes this. He sends a question to Rav Yitzchok Elchanan Spector, the Rav of Kovno, considered the greatest posek, the end of the 20th century. Rav Yaakov Reitz, who Yeshiva University is named after, original constructor. So he sent him a shayla, and he said, I want a one-word answer, yes or no. That's it, one-word answer. Because if you give me a reason, I'm going to disagree with you. Whatever reason you're going to give me, I'm going to be able to give a counter-argument, in which case I won't be able to accept your halakha. Because if this is also true, if a rabbi gives you a reason and it makes no sense to you, you can't follow him. Oh, the rabbi told me it's allowed. What do you mean? So, no, yeah, got to use your brain a little bit. If you don't understand something, the rabbi has to explain it to you. That's not how halacha works. Unless you want to be kapuf, totally, you know, I just follow my rebbe, whatever he wants. So that's what Rav Chaim Soloveitchik said. If you give me a reasoning, I'm going to give you 10 reasons why your reasoning is no good, and then I won't be able to follow the argument you give because I don't agree with you. So I can't follow your ruling. So just give me I know you're such a great rabbi. You're the greatest halakhic authority. Whatever you tell me, so it's an interesting story. Again, I don't know 100% it's true, but this story is Rav Zevin writes it in Ishim Ushitot. So Rav Zevin was a reliable person, I think. So it's an interesting idea that, but right, this idea that the rabbi says something without giving a reason, that's not how halakha works. Halakha is you give a reason and people argue about it and we debate it. And in fact, the consensus emerges, or I follow Rav Moshe Feinstein, you know, usually I'm not so smart. I don't know enough to know to argue. Rav Chaim Brisker can argue on Rav Yitzchok Elchanan. Most people don't know enough. Rav Moshe, I don't know enough to argue on his reasoning. But for a great rabbi, so that's an interesting story. Okay. All right. Anything else? And thank you very much.
I have special regards for you from your cousin, Sharon Kowalski.
We
met her in Avram on the street in Mayor Sharon. Okay.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Great, great. Yeah, from course, keep talking for us. Yes. My eldest first cousin, Sharon, is the, they're a great couple, Avram and Sharon. Thank you very much. Yes.
Yeah, I was at their wedding a little while ago.
I was also at their wedding. I was 7 years old at their wedding. Yeah. Yes. You were probably a little bit older. I was 7 years old at their wedding. My first cousin. I vaguely remember the wedding, actually. At the Hilton Hotel. The Stafford Hilton Hotel in Manhattan.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Anyhow, have a wonderful Shabbos.
Everybody be well. Great.
Toda, excellent, and thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay. Be well. Okay.
Shabbos.
Shabbos.